Ambassador Taylor, in your decades of military service and diplomatic service representing the United States around the world, have you ever seen another example of foreign aid conditioned on the personal or political interests of the President of the United States?
No, Mr. Goldman, I've not.
This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Wednesday, November 13th, day one of the public impeachment hearings. The voices in that leadoff clip were today's central witness, President Trump's current ambassador to Ukraine, William Taylor, being questioned by Daniel Goldman, a staff attorney and director of investigations with the House Intelligence Committee on the Democratic side. It's the beginning of the process to determine if President Trump abused the powers of his office and put both America and Ukraine at risk for his personal advantage. We're recording this at 2:30 after Ambassador Taylor and State Department official George Kent, who oversees U.S.-Ukraine policy, gave opening statements and were questioned by attorneys for both parties, 45 minutes each, plus some of the House members themselves. So I think we've got the real news of the day by now. We'll talk with two guests in just a minute. I'll play one important excerpt first that was newsworthy, that revealed something new that Ambassador Taylor testified to. Taylor said that he was told just last Friday by a member of his staff about a conversation that took place back on July 26th. Now, that's a key day because it was the day after the famous Trump-Zelensky phone call.
In the presence of my staff, at a restaurant, Ambassador Sondland called President Trump and told him of his meetings in Kyiv. The member of my staff could hear President Trump on the phone asking Ambassador Sondland about the investigations. Ambassador Sondland told President Trump the Ukrainians were ready to move forward. Following the call with President Trump, the member of my staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland responded that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden, which Giuliani was pressing for.
We'll talk about that new testimony now and the whole day so far with Jason Zengerle, New York Times Magazine reporter, who wrote an article last week called Inside Adam Schiff's Impeachment Game Plan, and Heather Hurlburt, director of the New Models of Policy Change Program at the think tank New America, a New York Magazine contributor and a former senior official in President Bill Clinton's White House and State Department. Jason and Heather, we really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
We'll play more excerpts as we go, but Heather, let me dive right in on that newsworthy story as described by Ambassador Taylor. What do you find new and significant there?
So the thing that it demonstrates, I think, is the directness of the president's connection to what was happening, and that there have been various efforts to say, oh, this was Sondland, or this was Giuliani, or this was somebody else, but the description of the call is Sondland, who the president has, I believe, said he barely knows, calling directly to the president and saying, hi, this is what's going on with the Ukrainians. The president being not just keenly interested, but keenly interested, as the staffer reported, in the investigate the Biden's angle as opposed to the U.S. foreign policy toward Ukraine angle. So I think it gets us another step closer to the thing that House Democrats want to demonstrate, which is that the president personally is orchestrating this effort to pressure a foreign government in exchange for advantage in an election campaign.
Ambassador Sondland, who's referred to there, Heather, is scheduled as a witness for a public hearing next week in this process. What's the significance for President Trump, as far as you could tell so far, if Sondland confirms that story?
Well, it gets us one step closer to the idea that Trump is personally doing this and knowingly trying to change official U.S. foreign policy for partisan gain.
Jason, based on your reporting on Adam Schiff's impeachment game plan, did he get what he was hoping for from Ambassador Taylor today?
I think so. I think Taylor was a very steady and compelling witness. You can see why Democrats wanted him to go first. Republicans are making a big deal about how everything he is saying is hearsay, and he himself had never talked to President Trump, and they're trying to question his testimony on those grounds. I mean, of course, the White House is not letting anyone who has talked to President Trump about this actually testify, whether it's John Bolton or Mick Mulvaney or Secretary Pompeo.
Except Ambassador Sondland, who will come in next week.
Well, they're not letting him testify. Ambassador Sondland is deciding to testify on his own. I think he's been told not to testify. So I think if they had their druthers, Ambassador Sondland wouldn't testify. And I think his testimony next week is shaping up to be a big moment, because Sondland is someone who I don't think he wants to be known as the person who brought down President Trump. I think that he is, to a certain degree, a Trump loyalist. But at the same time, he was talking to enough people about this that he's now being reminded of conversations he had, and he's already had to go back once and amend his testimony. And now with this revelation today from Ambassador Taylor, I believe the Foreign Service officer who overheard this conversation, I think it's been reported his name is David Holmes, and he's going to be testifying in closed-door setting on Friday to the Intelligence Committee. I think Ambassador Sondland might have to refresh his testimony again. It seems as if Sondland is really... He's not quite kicking and screaming, but he's testifying reluctantly, it seems.
He's a Trump loyalist who got his ambassadorship after donating $1 million to the Trump campaign in 2016 with no previous government or foreign policy experience. He got named ambassador to EU, and now he's all caught up in this thing. So let's take a step back now and listen to about 45 seconds of Chairman Schiff's opening statement. This is part of what he wanted the American people to hear first thing this morning. Then we'll play part of the Republicans' opening statement. But this is part of what Chairman Schiff wanted the American people to hear first thing this morning when they turned on their phones and their TVs.
The issue that we confront is the one posed by the president's acting chief of staff when he challenged Americans to get over it. If we find that the president of the United States abused his power and invited foreign interference in our elections, or if he sought to condition, coerce, extort, or bribe an ally into conducting investigations to aid his reelection campaign and did so by withholding official acts, a White House meeting, or hundreds of millions of dollars of needed military aid, must we simply get over it? Is this what Americans should now expect from their president? If this is not impeachable conduct, what is?
So, Jason, I'll stay with you for a minute and ask, could you put that part of the opening statement in the context of Chairman Schiff's impeachment game plan as you reported on it?
Well, Schiff spends a lot of time thinking about his opening statements. It's something that he's become known for in the past couple of years. If you remember when Director Comey had his testimony before the House Intelligence Committee, when Schiff was the ranking member, when the House was controlled by Republicans, Schiff really connected the dots, as we understood them at the time, about Russia's interference in the 2016 election and various Russians' interactions with Trump campaign officials. And in a lot of ways, that opening statement really set the narrative for the next couple of years of the Russia investigation. I think Schiff is trying to do the same thing here. He wants his opening argument and his opening statement to zoom out a bit and try to tell a bigger story, put a larger narrative than just these sort of granular details. And I think those are the big questions that he's trying to get at and set the table. He's trying to really set the table for what's going to come from all this very detailed testimony that we saw today and that we'll see later this week and next week.
So that was 45 seconds of Chairman Schiff. Now we'll play 45 seconds of the ranking Republican, Devin Nunes. His game plan here sounds like it is to convince the public that the Democrats are focusing solely on President Trump's behavior, which is not okay, that this whole process also needs the context of the behavior of others.
We should not hold any hearings at all until we get answers to three crucial questions the Democrats are determined to avoid asking. First, what is the full extent of the Democrats' prior coordination with the whistleblower? And who else did the whistleblower coordinate this effort with? Second, what is the full extent of Ukraine's election meddling against the Trump campaign? And third, why did Burisma hire Hunter Biden? And what did he do for them? And did his position affect any U.S. government actions under the Obama administration? These questions will remain outstanding because Republicans were denied the right to call witnesses that know these answers.
So, Heather, how would you compare the Adam Schiff game plan and the Devin Nunes game plan based on those comparative statements and anything else you heard today?
Well, as you said, the Nunes game plan, I think, has two components. One is, maybe three. One is to expand the frame to include a whole range of other issues, some of which are, some of which are well reported and sourced by reputable news organizations, and some of which venture pretty far into the territory of unsubstantiated conspiracy theory. So Nunes is mixing up what I would regard as matters of fact and interpretation with matters of conspiracy theory. And the Republican questioning, at least as far as we had gotten before 2:30, continued to do that. The second line of Republican counterattack is whatever happened wasn't a problem. It was well within the realm of normal. It was completely normal for Republicans to and the White House to challenge and hold up the aid. It was completely normal to have concerns about any and all kinds of corruption in Ukraine. And then, you know, that takes you all the way to the Mick Mulvaney. It's completely normal to mix politics and foreign aid. And then I think the third element of what was going on in the Republican game plan, where I think Schiff and his team are focusing on sort of undecided public opinion, or that part of public opinion that is not already enthusiastic about the idea of impeachment. You saw several lines of Republican questioning that seemed much more to be aimed at true believers and shoring up an audience that already knows some of these lines of argumentation, rather than trying to bring over any new supporters to their point of view on this. So the two strategies are not exactly parallel in that way.
Interesting. And I guess, Heather, that would be because if just the current doubters of the value of impeachment hold that position at the end of this process, then there won't be enough support in Republican America for the Senate to feel that they need to vote the president out, all those Senate Republicans.
That, and I would also add that Republican communicators always know now that their biggest audience is sitting at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue watching their performances, judging them, and if they're particularly good or judge not good, tweeting about them. So I think it was hard at times this morning to escape the idea that some of this was a performance to show the president how well he was being defended, at least as much as to actually defend him.
So here's maybe an example of that. We heard Ambassador Taylor in the clip we played break the news about what he heard last week about the July 26th phone call between Sondland and the president. Later, Republican Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio tried to cast doubt on Taylor's assertion that he had a clear understanding that military aid to Ukraine was being tied to political investigations, partly through that phone call. Here's Jim Jordan.
Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told Ambassador Taylor that I told Mr. Morrison that I conveyed this message to Mr. Yarmak on September 1st, 2019, in connection with Vice President Pence's visit to Warsaw and a meeting with President Zelensky. Now, this is his clarification. We got six people having four conversations in one sentence, and you just told me this is where you got your clear understanding.
So, Heather, did Jordan establish anything there, or how do you come out of this as a former foreign policy official yourself, understanding Taylor's real body of knowledge about the president's intent?
Well, yeah, so two things. One was that was just extraordinarily confusing to me, and I had been sitting watching this all day and following it fairly closely. So that's a clip that I think is useful to play for some audiences to convince them that Taylor and Kent and others can't possibly know what they say they know. And, you know, from the point of view of someone who has sat in those meetings and read the cables and been part of the conversation and tried to craft, help craft the strategies around them, you know, it was, there was an extraordinary level of, well, you couldn't possibly know what the president was thinking, or you couldn't possibly know what the president wanted. Well, that's an extraordinary level of dysfunction if it's not perfectly clear to everyone working in administration what a president is trying to do or what a White House is trying to do. So I think underlying all of this is an argument that you didn't actually hear made today, but you have heard made in some other context in the last week or so, which is, well, this was incompetence rather than malice. And that, I mean, you saw those gentlemen, they are in no way incompetent.
And Jason, Congressman Jordan was just added to the committee for the purpose of these hearings. Why him? And do we hear it in that clip?
Yeah, I think you do hear it in that clip. He's a very aggressive questioner. I mean, I really felt bad for whoever was having to transcribe that hearing whenever he was talking, because he speaks extremely fast and he gets a lot of information out there quickly, so much information that it becomes confusing, I think, for people to listen to.
I will say that sympathy for the stenographers is not one thing that often comes up in the interview, so I'm glad to hear this. Go ahead.
But he, you know, I think that he is a very he's a very aggressive defender of the president. During the closed door depositions, he was certainly taking that role on, and you saw that in the transcripts. Nunes didn't even go to all of the closed door depositions. I think Jordan was just a more active participant, and then just his personality. You know, he was a college wrestler, and he was a college wrestling coach, and you can still kind of see that in him. Having him face off against Taylor, I thought, was a really interesting moment. I thought the counsel for the Republicans, his line of questioning, was a good counterpoint to Jordan's. It was very confusing. It was very muddled. I think Taylor at certain points almost seemed bemused by the questioning from the Republican counsel. And I think other times you've seen Republican members up there, their questioning hasn't been as sharp. I think Ratcliffe and Jordan are the two Republicans on the committee that the White House wants asking questions. And they do it in a very aggressive, confrontational way in which they don't really give the witnesses much of a chance to respond, and they're therefore able to sow some doubt.
And here is perhaps the weakest moment for Ambassador Taylor, and it is under questioning from Steve Castor, who you just mentioned, the general counsel for the Republicans on the House Oversight Committee, who got 45 minutes to cross-examine the witnesses. He's trying to establish here that President Trump's July 25th phone call with Zelensky was okay, not incriminating. Of course, Trump calls it perfect, even though he seemed to link military aid to investigations of the Bidens and 2016. So in this exchange, Attorney Castor refers to the investigation that Attorney General Barr has launched into the origins of the Russia investigation in 2016 and tries to legitimize Trump asking for Ukraine to cooperate with that investigation with this question.
So when the president on the call transcript of July 25th raises this with President Zelensky, and he urges that there be a connection between the Ukrainian government and the Justice Department officially, I mean, that's the appropriate way to raise an issue with the Ukrainian president, correct?
It's appropriate for the Justice Department and the Prosecutor General to cooperate and to exchange information, yes.
But to the extent the President has concerns and to the extent the Attorney General is having the U.S. Attorney Durham look into that, isn't it entirely appropriate for the President to flag this for President Zelensky and say that you should be in touch with our official channels?
Ms. Castro, I don't know the precise appropriateness of these kinds of relations.
So, Heather, you heard Ambassador Taylor squirm a bit in that response, something he didn't do much of during the course of the whole first hours of testimony. To your ear, did the Republicans score any points there on Trump's right to ask Ukraine to cooperate with an official U.S. Justice Department probe?
I mean, the only way I think that gives Republicans something useful is if Taylor had said something affirmative. I mean, I can't believe that I don't know gets you anything really, really useful there. It was as you say, it was a bit surprising to me that Taylor didn't say, never in my 50-year career in government have I heard of a president requesting assistance in the investigation of a rival. But I can't even imagine what it would be like to be in that seat under that much pressure for that long. And I don't think, I mean,
well,
just
let me jump in. Let me jump in for a second, because I think he did say, and we played this at the very top of the show, he did say something that was a very clear, direct, you know, simple declarative statement to the point you were just making, I think. Yeah. Let's listen. Yeah.
Ambassador Taylor, in your decades of military service and diplomatic service representing the United States around the world, have you ever seen another example of foreign aid conditioned on the personal or political interests of the President of the United States?
No, Mr. Goldman, I've not.
Heather.
Yeah, so this is a great way to say something about our diplomatic corps and what you saw on display in the hearings today, that Taylor would feel very comfortable making an absolute blanket statement about conditioning foreign aid for political purposes, because that's absolutely in his bailiwick. The Barr investigation, however, is something different. And a diplomat would always be hesitant to pronounce on something that's outside his or her direct purview. So I think that explains why Taylor felt so comfortable being categorical with respect to the conditioning of the assistance, not with respect to the investigation.
I think that's exactly right. I didn't think Taylor was squirming during the Castor questioning, especially that part, as much as he was befuddled by it. Taylor spent a lot of time watching the Fox News primetime lineup probably in the past 6 months. And I think that Castor's questioning reflected that worldview. It was going down a number of rabbit holes that Nunes himself has gone down, that Hannity's gone down. And it was fascinating just watching Taylor, just looking at his face as he was being asked these questions that I think to him must have seemed just out of left field. And I just didn't take that as squirming as much as just not really even understanding what Castor was trying to get at.
Jason, we were all expecting procedural histrionics from the Republicans to focus on procedure and due process rather than the president's behavior. Here's a moment of that with Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik of New York, as Chairman Schiff acknowledges right at the beginning that the witnesses were sworn in.
Let the record show that the witnesses answered in the affirmative. Thank you, and please be seated.
Mr. Chairman, before we hear from the witnesses, I have a parliamentary inquiry.
The gentleman will state her parliamentary inquiry.
Mr. Chairman, when can we anticipate a response to our November 9th letter requesting certain individual witnesses to be called?
The gentlewoman should be aware that three of the witnesses the minority has requested are scheduled for next week.
Your witnesses, Mr. Chairman. What about the additional six witnesses?
The gentlewoman may inquire about additional witnesses or make a request for a vote on additional witnesses following the witness testimony.
And so I guess there are going to be votes later today on additional witnesses. Jason, play out both sides of that in game plan terms for us. Would you? What did we hear there?
Well, the Republicans have asked for a list of witnesses, a number of which they know that the Democrats will never agree to. I think the two most notable would be Hunter Biden and the whistleblower. It's no surprise that Schiff would reject these. To be honest, I actually thought there were going to be more procedural hiccups today. I thought there obviously were a few at the beginning of the hearings with Stefanik, and I think Ratcliffe got in there as well with some questions, or maybe Conaway. But they were more restrained than they thought they were going to be. I thought you were going to see more points of order than they actually raised. And the hearing, I thought, proceeded more smoothly than you might have expected.
I agree. It was more tame than I expected from the Republican procedural point interruption standpoint. Do you think that was strategy? Do you think they were more worried about shooting themselves in the foot than scoring any points?
I think they were confident in Jordan's questioning. The 45 minutes from Nunes and Castor was a dud, but when Jordan and Ratcliffe were up there and you saw the other members yielding to them, I think that they were satisfied with the results they were getting from that, and that lessened the need for procedural objections.
So before you both go, how did it just feel for you as Americans? I guess you can't detach yourselves from, you know, your jobs and your careers in the context of your professional lives. Jason, you're a journalist covering Washington. Heather, you're a senior, former senior diplomat yourself. But how did this feel watching this historic moment, day one of what's going to be a number of historic moments over the next few weeks related? How did it feel watching this go down, Heather?
You know, I'm a child of Watergate. Actually, my dad was a congressional staffer at the beginning of Watergate, and I've always grown up with this lore about we had moved outside Washington by the time the hearings happened, and all the moms in my neighborhood getting together and hiring a babysitter so they could watch the hearings on TV. The dad, this was the 70s in the suburbs, the dad's coming home from work at the end of the day and finding all the kids running around wild and unfed, and the moms tipsy and angry at the state of the world from having watched the impeachment hearings all day. And, you know, it's not cocktail time and I'm stone cold sober, but I really relate to that. And I'm actually going to, after this interview, I'm going to call my mother and say, you know, I feel like I've shared this very depressing intergenerational experience with you.
Jason.
I have similar feelings of depression. At the same time, I had a lot of admiration for Taylor and Kent. And I think there are a lot of people like that in government service who we never see and we have no exposure to. But their competence and their integrity, I thought that was really made clear in their testimony. And I think you're seeing right now a real conflict inside our government between people who have that expertise and have that discipline and have that competence and work through regular channels. And then you're seeing these irregular channels or these back channels and the difficulty that arise from those. And in some ways I found it reassuring that there's still people like that who want to work in government and who are working in government. And I think that as depressing as all of this is and as upsetting as all of it is, in some small measure, you can take a little bit of reassurance that those people still exist.
Jason Zengerle and Heather Hurlburt, thank you for giving us such a good start to our coverage here on day one of public hearings on Impeachment, a daily podcast. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
One more thing before we go. We're inviting you to write your own article of impeachment. Go to our website, impeachmentpodcast.org, and you'll see the instructions. Write one article of impeachment that you think would hold up against President Trump. Later, we'll invite Trump defenders to refute your arguments, but if you think you can write one article of impeachment against the president that should hold up, go to our website, impeachmentpodcast.org, and you'll see how to submit it. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at wnyc.org. See you tomorrow.